You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good afternoon. If I could ask everyone to please take your seats so that we can begin on time and stay on schedule, I would appreciate it. My name is Mark Roman, and I am currently the Chief Privacy Officer of the Federal Trade Commission on a detail to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where I'm working on issues related to technology, privacy, and data security. And I will be the moderator of this panel this afternoon. The panel is Debating the Framework for Online Privacy, a really timely topic today. I'd like to begin first by introducing our panel of really extraordinary experts in the field, and then we'll go right into our laying the foundation for the panel and our discussion. All the way on the end of the table, to my right, is Ari Schwartz. Ari is the Vice President and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology, one of the preeminent experts inside the Beltway on information privacy and information policy. And we're delighted to have Ari on this panel. To Ari's left is Ann Toth, the Vice President of Policy and Head of Privacy at Yahoo. Ann has been there for 10-plus years and handles a wide variety of issues, including privacy and other consumer issues. Then comes Chuck Curran, who is the Executive Director and General Counsel for the Network Advertising Initiative. Prior to that, Chuck was the AOL Chief Counsel for Policy, where he handled a wide variety of issues, including privacy, data security, spam, and other issues. And then immediately to my right is the Honorable Philip Dunn, a Member of Parliament from the United Kingdom. Mr. Dunn was first elected to Parliament in 2005. He's held a variety of leadership positions with the Conservative Party. And one thing I found interesting about your bio is a very impressive 20-year experience in business, both small and large, ranging from investment banking to starting a book business. And so Mr. Dunn brings a wealth of experience to this panel as well. The way this will work for the balance of the afternoon is I will do a 3 or 4 minute overview to set the stage for our discussion today. Then each panelist will have 3 minutes to do an opening presentation or opening remarks, and I literally will cut them off to keep it quick and short. Then we'll have a moderated discussion, and I promise to leave at the very least 20 minutes for audience Q&A, if not more than that, to make it a really lively discussion and debate on the topic. So in order to frame the debate for this afternoon, I'm certainly not going to do an overview of the U.S. privacy framework or the EU privacy framework, but I thought I would take 3 minutes to review some events of the past few months that really make this discussion today particularly timely. So if we look back, over the past year, there were 4 hearings in the House Energy and Commerce Committee on 2 subcommittees that touched a wide variety of privacy issues, including deep packet inspection, online behavioral advertising, information brokers, and the online and offline merging of data. All those occurred last year. The Federal Trade Commission is actively exploring privacy right now. They are holding a series of 3 privacy forums to examine the U.S. privacy framework and evolving models for privacy. I think most people here know the next one is tomorrow in California. In addition, the FTC last year issued a report on online behavioral advertising and potential principles for self-regulation. And many people have heard recent speeches and remarks by both Chairman Leibowitz and the Bureau Director David Vladek expressing a strong interest in privacy and a strong interest in re-examining the privacy framework. I want to emphasize that over the last year, I think we've seen some enormous and really amazing initiatives in the private sector, whether it's self-regulation through trade association efforts, like at the NAI, IAB, the BBB, or trustee, or specific privacy initiatives at companies that have enhanced transparency and give consumers control. I think that is a really positive step from last year. But that being said, consumer groups and privacy advocates continue to call for privacy legislation based on the fair information practices. And that leads me to look back at what Mr. Boucher, who is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Communications, Technology, and Internet, said this morning, that he fully intends to introduce a privacy bill this Congress, working in a bipartisan fashion, and we'll talk more about Mr. Boucher's proposals. And then I just want to close by looking to the other side of the Atlantic. There is obviously a different privacy framework in Europe, but they're having similar discussions right now. There is an ongoing review of the EU data directive. There are conversations going on about cookies and opting in. And there have been many discussions in Europe about deep packet inspection and in the UK, just like we have had here. So that is a quick overview of some of the events of the last 12 months that make this discussion today really timely. So with that, I want to turn it over right to our panelists for 3 minutes of sort of opening remarks before we dig into a debate on the privacy framework. And we'll start on the end with Ari.
Hi, thanks, Mark. Thanks for that nice introduction. It's great to be on a panel with I haven't met Mr. Dunn before, but the other panelists I know I've worked with for a long time are very nice and reasonable people on this topic. So I'm looking forward to having a good discussion on these issues. I'm just going to very briefly make a case for general consumer privacy law in this space. We've spent a lot of time focusing on the online space. We spend a lot of time focusing on specific technologies. But, the questions come up into consumer expectations. I think all the polls that you look at this area and generally when you talk to consumers in this space, you ask them about what they expect online, they do expect that companies are going to keep their information private and that they're going to allow the individual to remain in control of that information, to follow the fair information practices when you ask them one by one. It's gotten to the point where all of the polling is showing that. It used to be that business groups would try and poll and try and create counter polls in this area, but more recently the business groups that I've been seeing in this space have been saying, don't look at the polls, ignore the polls, you can't poll on this area, instead of trying to even come up with counter polls, because the polls go so strongly in favor of privacy, where even in the behavioral targeting space, the polls created by business still poll in about the 60% range of people that want to see a law in that area. The area where it gets to be a little bit more difficult is that it's hard to pass a more general consumer privacy law, an online and offline law that would be really helpful for consumers and create an even playing field. We often talk about the fact that it's often said, especially in Europe, the U.S. doesn't have a privacy law. In fact, we have dozens and dozens of privacy laws covering different industries, covering different technologies, and each of those sort of pigeonholes different types of techniques to deal with privacy issues, mostly based on fair information practices, each one slightly different, and companies in the online space are covered or not covered by this, and it gets to be a confusing mess for consumers, certainly, but I also think it gets to be a mess for businesses as well. And it also raises the issue where every new technology that comes up, we have this question, what should the privacy rules be for this new technology, rather than have a consistent baseline that we can work from to build up new protections to really make sure that consumers are being protected, that they have those protections in place. That's why we've seen a bunch of companies jump in and actually support privacy legislation in this space. I mean, I think we would have to figure out exactly if it's what consumer groups and these companies can agree to, but Microsoft, HP, Intel, eBay, Google, a lot of very large companies in this space have supported privacy legislation because of the harmonization issues, because they follow these practices around the world already, and because their consumers expect it from them. So the question is, can we get to a point where we can get something through that is reasonable? I think it's been a strong effort from Chairman Boucher to put forward a proposal in this space, knowing that it's going to come up for criticism, knowing that it's probably not going to be signed into law this year, but to start down that path and to put out that outline as a starting point for us to move forward from. Thank you.
Great. All right. Thanks for the opening remarks. Anne.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to actually try to keep my remarks very brief so that we can dive into what I hope is a very vigorous debate here today. As Mark mentioned, I've been doing online privacy for Yahoo for over a decade. I actually started in 1998, and it was the same month that the FTC sent their report to Congress that month, which resulted in the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act later that year. So in internet time, since I've been doing this 11 and a half years, I think that means I've been doing privacy for about 700 offline years, is my guess. But I think, I raise that as a context-setting point because I think if you look over the last decade, there have been incremental improvements in the self-regulatory framework for online privacy, but I really have not seen a year where there's been as much dramatic improvement in industry self-regulation as 2009 alone. So right around 2008, at the end of the year, was when I first started coming to Washington. I'm actually based in Sunnyvale, but I've all but sort of set up a tent and camped out here in D.C. To tell folks about some of the things we've been doing. We announced our data retention policy, certainly spurred by some interest from folks across the pond, looking at data retention issues. So we reduced that period of time from 13 months of holding identifiable log files to 90 days for the most part, which was a dramatic reduction in that period of time. And that actually applies not just to the log files that we use for search, but really for log files that inform all of our ad serving systems. Obviously, there's been a great deal of interest in online advertising and the privacy implications of that. So that was how we started our 2009. But throughout the year, we've been working with folks in industry, folks at the NAI, and across our other peer companies to try to come up with a model and a framework that would scale to give consumers better notice and more ready access to choices. And that's resulted in, I'm sure many of you read the New York Times article about the selection of an icon by industry in order to really come to a consistent way of giving users notice in and around an ad when that ad is actually delivered to them. With Yahoo, we've been testing this model, and if you click on that icon that we're running on the Yahoo Green site, you can actually go right to our ad interest manager that shows users what kind of things we think they're interested in and allows them to actually say, you know, I'm interested in retail shoes, maybe not so much automotives. My profile over Christmas was quite interesting. There were a whole lot of gaming systems on there for my kids. I can go in there and remove them right now because they've got every gaming system known to man now. So I can take that off of there, or I can opt out of everything. I can see why Yahoo might think I'm interested in those categories. So that kind of unprecedented transparency is really what a lot of companies in our space are moving towards. And, you know, so I think those are the kinds of improvements that we've laid out in 2009. I'm really excited about what's coming up in 2010. It may be the case that the self-regulatory model is going to be more of a is going to be a bit of a relic in an age where we may actually have a law or regulatory action. But I think we can look towards all of the good work we've done in self-regulation as a model for the types of things we can look at in regulation itself. So I will wrap up before the music starts. Mm-hmm.
Well, as the lead of your self-regulatory trade group, I don't plan to be a relic with the legislative outcome. Certainly with Chairman Boucher's proposals, we've certainly been heartened by the amount of attention that's been given to industry best practices and self-regulation and all the work that's being done. And certainly it's a very good sign from our perspective that there is such awareness that self-regulation remains the most effective way to rapidly deploy on an ecosystem-wide basis, the kinds of tools that certainly in the behavioral targeting space, people that the kind of notice that advocates and consumers and regulators have been looking for. So, and I want to emphasize the kind of the industry-wide aspect of this. You have the announcement today with the informational eye. And, you know, this represents really an unprecedented collaboration across. You have web publishers, you have ad networks that work with them, we have advertisers, we have consumer groups, and the goal of all of this, moving at self-regulatory speed, is to do things in a consistent way so that we don't flunk the test of consumer acceptance when we move from outside of the privacy policy world to a world where it comes to BT, where we do the notice outside the privacy policy. We have to do it in a consistent way. By way of moving the conversation along, I would throw out the idea that while we're certainly solving to the issue of behavioral targeting outside the privacy policy, I think there is an interesting question as it relates to other privacy issues. What does, in the context of broader online privacy legislation, does life outside the privacy policy necessarily look like? How do we, if we solve to one particular issue with particular notice sets, well, what is exactly is the model? Speaking as someone who spent many long years slaving over short-form privacy policies and other forms of attempted disclosures that weren't quite as long and lengthy as the documents that everybody complains about, I think it's a huge task to figure out from a legislative perspective, and that's fortunately Mark's job and not mine, to actually figure out how it is that we segregate amongst all the different issues that consumers, that may be material to the consumers, and establish a robust and yet non-annoying system for providing that information.
Great, thank you. Well, Mark, you introduced this session by saying how timely it was, and I think I just need to start by reiterating that, not just this discussion about privacy, but the conference as a whole. Yesterday in the UK, we were debating, at least not I, but my colleagues who were there, were debating the Digital Economy Bill. Today, the British government has published its ICT strategy, a rather long-awaited document, which I haven't read in complete detail yet because it's only just come out this morning. So these issues are very alive amongst the UK legislature at the moment and are taking increasing prominence in the political debate in the UK and in Europe. I would say one of the key reasons for that is because we've had an increasing number, as I fear is the case everywhere around the globe, an increasing number of breaches of data security, which is leading to an increasing lack of trust amongst the public in government protection of data, but also, I'm afraid, in some of the private sector protection of data. And it seems to me that we need, both as an industry and as governments, to find ways to restore trust in data management, because if we don't, we will all suffer the consequences. One of the aspects of the British system that we have is we do a lot of work on a bipartisan basis outside of the legislature. And the delegation that's come here, you've heard one or two people speaking today, are from a cross-party. I'm involved in another cross-party group, which is called the Information Society Alliance, which includes members of the European Parliament. And some of the work streams that we've been doing is involved in information governance. And I was particularly encouraged to hear Howard Schmidt earlier talking about the importance of privacy from his role, but also the importance of security and designing security into products available online and in the cloud. And I think that is absolutely right, and it is critical that industry works out security measures to design into products so that we're not seeking to patch problems after they've arisen, but we're thinking ahead all the time. And our all-party Information Society Alliance is going to be publishing some thoughts that we've been working up with industry practitioners and parliamentarians and legislators in the UK next month. So again, things coming out of this conference will be fed back into that exercise. So it's a great pleasure to be here. I look forward to getting into the discussion about some of the proposals that you have here.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think those opening remarks really help set the stage. And now I'm going to start with a first question. So Mr. Boucher spoke this morning, again, chairman of the Subcommittee on Communications, Technology, and the Internet for the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He has been saying and reiterated today his intention to introduce a privacy bill. I know that the organizers of the conference had hoped I'd be reading from that privacy bill today. But I will not be. However, I think that there are a number of ways to start this debate and the many issues we could discuss. And the way I'm going to start it is by referring to an article that Mr. Boucher published, which outlines his proposed framework for a privacy bill, and ask our panelists to comment on that and offer their thoughts on that framework. And I want everyone to know that I am not reading from a bill, but I'm reading from an article in The Hill. And certainly, it is possible that things have evolved since this was published, but it's a way to start the debate and the discussion today about what an online or offline privacy bill could look like. And I'll also note that Mr. Boucher's proposed bill addresses consumer privacy in the private sector, doesn't address the public sector, which is another issue that could be addressed. But the way Mr. Boucher framed this in his op-ed in The Hill is that a proposed legislation would include disclosure, so that consumers would be given clear, concise information on what data is collected, how it is used, the purposes, how long it's stored, and other information. There would be regs or statutory provisions concerning collection. There would be an opt-out for collection of information for first party from the website. However, there would be an express opt-in for certain categories of sensitive information. Then he goes on to discuss the uses of information and says, again, with respect to uses, there would be an opt-out for first party. But as it's stated, if a website wants to provide information to an unrelated third party, there would be required an affirmative opt in. So he mentioned this morning a series of opt-in and opt-out choices. That's how it's framed in the Hill piece. He goes on to discuss a potential safe harbor and then states that the FTC would be the implementing and enforcing agency. So that's a high-level overview of Mr. Boucher's proposal as written up in the Hill. And so let's start down the line. I'll start with my colleague here, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you, Mark. Well, it seems to me that the chairman has been reading European legislation, because much of this was included in the EU directive way back in 1995, which led to laws across Europe, including the Data Protection Act in 1998. The core principles of that were much as you've described here. It was about providing a legislative framework for retention of or provision of data by individuals to third parties and the rules under which that would be governed. And the abiding principle was that we should have, as an individual, provide positive consent for information to be made available. So opting in is how most information is provided. There are exemptions in certain cases. So the marketing of similar products and services, you can tick an opt-out box if you're willing to allow your data to be used for that purpose. But the core abiding element is that the information is available for the purpose for which it was originally provided, for the business that is being transacted, and then it ceases to be available. So it covers specific purpose, no third-party disclosure other than with consent, another carve-out for legislation. Obviously, if there's an overriding legislative reason to retain it, then that overrides. An individual retains right of access over his own information, and it's provided for no longer than it's necessary. And that's essentially the main point. Now, there is a key problem with this Act, which is why it's currently under review across Europe, and that is that it's applicable only within the economic the EEA, the European Economic Area, and with the migration of to the cloud or to other jurisdictions, that clearly gives rise to a challenge, and that's it's really jurisdiction and territoriality that is, I think, the big issue for us to resolve at the moment.
Anne, how about you?
Well, you know, earlier Ari mentioned his opening remarks about a number of companies that have been very supportive of the notion of privacy legislation. And I think if you asked representatives of a lot of those companies if they support online privacy legislation or privacy legislation, they would probably not be looking for a law that specifically deals with the online space. The one thing that I am struck by, you know, most online advertising, most behavioral advertising that happens online happens not with any specific individual's name, telephone number, street address, credit card numbers. It's happening with a cookie identifier. And we take great pains to de-identify a lot of that data in our records. The thing that I wonder about, you know, when I the day after I gave birth to my second child, I showed up at home and I had a big old can of Enfamil waiting for me, delivered directly to my home, using the fact that I had just given birth. It was marketing, and what happens online is marketing, and it happens in a way that's generally a lot less intrusive and a lot less personally identifiable than what I experienced when I got home and found that can of formula waiting for me there. And so when we think about offline direct marketing, virtually none of that happens in an opt-in way. At least I can't think of any time a telemarketer's asked me to opt-in or a direct marketer's asked me to opt-in. Yet in the online space, we're talking about opt-in. And so I'm struck by the thinking today that, in fact, there may be even greater privacy protections that many companies are offering online that you may not even see in offline marketing that is leveraging personal information. So I can go now to Yahoo and see my segments, and I can modify them, and I can opt out of all of them if I like. I don't think I have that level of transparency or access to much of the offline marketing information that exists about me in the world today. I don't know where I'd even go to see it, and I'm not sure who I'd ask in order to modify any of it. And if I had to, I'd probably have to write a letter or make some phone calls. Online, I can access that now from an ad, go right to the place where I can opt out. And those are things that I think, as we think about this, a regulatory model, should certainly be considered as part of the safe harbor provisions. I think a lot of people are going to focus on that because that's where we're hoping we can codify some of the self-regulatory principles that we think the better actors are already complying with. So I know that was a little bit scattered, but...
Can I just follow up on that with a question, and then we'll turn to Ari? So am I hearing you say that if you were able to offer some advice to Mr. Boucher or the staff working on the bill, that you would encourage them to look beyond online to also offline as they develop a statutory framework?
I think it's important to consider, and it's certainly a big... It's a big bite to take, right, to look at online and offline all at once. But marketing is, what we're talking about with behavioral advertising is one form of direct marketing, essentially. There is a lot of marketing that happens. And so when I think about it, and I think about the fact that most data, all data, really, at the end of the day, is digital, to look at this and say, you know, the data that's collected about you or used for advertising purposes when you're on a website or when you're on, you know, if I go to Target.com or I go to Target, ultimately, that information is the same. If I'm making a purchase or transacting, it's the same thing. It's held in probably the same database. To say that we're going to treat some of it and the use of some of it for marketing purposes quite differently than others, just depending on the medium, I think is a bit of a... It creates some interesting challenges for businesses down the road. And I also think just in general about the pace of technology. I don't know if Steve Jobs has made his big announcement yet today about the iPad, iTouch, thing that he's putting out there. But I think all the time about just how rapidly things are changing and about how are we going to deal with notices and choices. And, you know, when we're dealing with users, in many cases, you know, who their primary means of accessing the internet is not on a PC or a Macintosh even, but really on their iPhone or their BlackBerry. So we need to have flexibility and we need the room to innovate. And if I were going to tell him online or offline, I'd say think about it in the broader sense for sure.
Ari?
I strongly agree with that point on online, offline, that it would be better to do it both at the same time. I think probably as compared to 10 years ago, it matters a little less because you're taking information from the online world and tying it to information that's in the offline world. Most companies are doing that today, so most companies are going to have this information covered, and it's going to be mixed together. It's probably going to matter less. However, I think that's even a stronger case to say, you know, let's be intellectually honest about this and just say we're covering everything if that's our intent. Because I think otherwise you end up with a kind of an idea that maybe you can separate these out, and that sends the wrong message. So I think, you know, we strongly prefer both an online, offline bill. But I also wanted to add one more piece that hasn't been raised in this discussion, but I know I've heard Representative Boucher raise in other times, which is the idea of allowing individuals to find out what information is held about mm-hmm. them and make sure that it's correct. Something that Yahoo has done, as Ann said, and other companies have been experimenting with, and I think we're finding good results out there that people want to see this. I think they're less likely to opt out when they actually see the information that's held about them, and they can have the ability to change it or delete it or to do other things with it to make sure that it's correct for them. I'll say that Yahoo didn't do such a good job with behaviorally targeting me, but I enjoyed the process anyways of finding out that they thought that I wanted a pickup truck and that I have a PlayStation at home, but which I don't.
You can opt out of those categories.
I did, which is the point. Yeah. But I think that even shows more so why it's necessary and something that's very useful. I think that's something that has to be limited. You can't just say you get access to everything, right? I mean, it has to be something. So we've talked about it for years. I mean, Paula Breening talks about it as ordinary course of business, information through the ordinary course of business. It's a way to talk about it in a useful way. But I also think something that impacts individuals, where you're going to get a different ad, right, if it's one way or the other, something that will make a difference for you directly, I think, is important as well. So. Just throwing out fair information.
So access and dispute resolution.
What's that?
Access and dispute resolution.
Yes.
I think, Ari, you really want a pickup truck, you just don't know it yet.
Well, it's not very practical for my current lifestyle. However, in the long run, maybe that would be true. Maybe Yahoo knows something about my far distant future that I don't know.
Chuck, are you eager to jump in?
Yeah, I would just add for the, you know, clearly the segment viewers, these are non-personally identifiable segments. They're guesses by the ad networks about what, apparently not always right about Ari, but they're, you know, attempted predictions. And clearly in this space, there's been a ton of activity. This is clearly the coming thing in terms of what our members are thinking about. But to go back to Boucher's proposal, I really think it is vitally important that there is some focus on the virtues of self-regulation and an incentive structure for all this work that companies are doing to invest in this infrastructure. There has to be carrots as well as sticks, because, you know, certainly from the perspective of the folks who are bringing you online behavioral advertising, you know, they are supporting an economic model that's trying to support the websites that people are using. We have incentives to have a structure in which the default experience is relevancy, but where we have to deliver on from the consumer privacy perspective is the appropriately robust notice of what's going on and the kinds of transparency that that you see members of our association like Yahoo bringing to the marketplace. So go ahead.
I'm wondering, getting a little more granular into the proposal as presented in the Hill article, so what do people think about the opt-out versus opt-in discussion, where it was opt-out for first-party, opt-in for collection and use of sensitive data to be defined, and opt-in for transfers of data to unrelated third parties?
You know, I think most companies get very nervous when they hear the words opt-in, because we try to imagine what that would actually look like. How would that consent be obtained in that particular fashion? And, you know, you can find examples of opt-ins that are perhaps not the most, not the best forms of, I mean, there are ways to do it that are really not so great. You can imagine going to a site and being told to use the site, you have to opt in. I'm not sure that's a very good choice to present it that way. We'd like to think that actually you can do opt-out in a way that's very transparent, very robust, and very easily accessible. And when you opt out, we think it should be persistent. You know, it should be there again the next time you come back. You shouldn't have to continue to opt out over and over and across every different device and do it differently. So we've implemented that. We think that that's a good way to go. But I think opt-in presents a lot of user experience challenges, particularly when you start to think about the mobile web and how you use devices that way and engaging with 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 20 different third parties that are seeking to get your opt-in consent every time you visit a website, I think is a user experience that wouldn't be particularly good for users or for usability across the web. But I also think that it's quite different when you consider, again, the offline model of where is opt-in consent required for use of personally identifiable or even sensitive information for marketing purposes. I haven't seen that level of or that kind of consent required in an offline world, and I'm not sure why we'd apply it in the first place in the online world.
I think you ought to come to Europe, and you'll find it. I mean, you have to treat this as a level playing field for both on and offline. No question about that. Mm-hmm. You can't for the reasons that you're arguing for opt out. You can't discriminate against technology either old or new. It's just not won't work. And we have long established practices for opting in tick box activities, both offline and online. It's happened. I accept that the increasing complexity makes it more difficult when you have multiple users potentially having access to the site through the sorts of things you're describing. My anxiety is that protecting for, you know, a relatively narrow band of very important user categories that you're representing, something which risks exposing the lack of trust in the entire online experience is a very, very big ask. And it's not one that certainly in Europe we've wanted to go down that route.
I'll say I feel as though sometimes that the opt-in, opt-out debate gets pushed a little bit too far, and that comes to be the center of attention on privacy, when in reality we have some very bad opt-ins out there. You can look at the supermarket shopping carts right now, where people, basically you have to do it if you're going shopping somewhere. The companies in general haven't known what they're going to do with this data. Right, they generally don't have limits on how long they're going to keep it, et cetera. They have, in other words, they have otherwise bad practices about what they're going to do with the data. But they get an opt-in from people by telling them you're going to save money if you do this. So, and people, you basically have to sign up. Now, I mean, it's not exactly the most robust system, and that you can trade cards or give fake information, which a lot of people do. But it is certainly it is an opt-in. So the question is, you know, what kind of opt-in are we talking about, and what kind of opt-out are we talking about? Because there have been some good opt-outs there that we've seen that are very easy to use, and we've seen some studies showing that if you give people a real choice, actually, between the two, rather than an opt-in or opt-out, you actually end up somewhere in between the two, and so there are other kind of options out there. I agree with Anne about the potential user interface on the issue, but I just wonder, you know, I'm more concerned, but just saying an opt-in or an opt-out, it matters more to me what the words actually say about how that consent is done than just saying opt-in or opt-out. So I'm going to look when there actually is a bill or proposal out there, that's what I'm going to be looking at, is really what the focus of the consent is and how it's done, more than in a proposal that comes out saying an opt-in or opt-out. I would say I am intrigued by the safe harbor idea. I don't know if it will work in the long run, but I think that trying to come up with incentives where safe harbors really work, one of the things we saw from the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act was that there was a safe harbor in there, and some companies signed up right away, and some companies never signed up because there was no real incentive to sign up, because if you're following the law and you're following the safe harbor, there's really no difference. So to try and come up with some good incentives for a safe harbor that push people to do allow people to have a little bit more flexibility, but then increase the oversight on that, I think that's something that may be a useful idea down the road if we can get it to work.
Well, I mean, I do have a never-ending list of questions I could ask the panel, but I would really like to get audience involvement really early on. So to the extent people have comments or questions, by all means, please come to the mic, introduce yourself, and fire away. And if no, okay.
Hi, Steve Del Bianco with NetChoice Coalition. And we were one of the groups that are out there constantly trying to stop states from erecting a patchwork of inconsistent laws. We actually sued the state of Maine last year over a ridiculous data collection law that they're subsequently going to repeal. But so I listened carefully for Congressman Boucher's speech this morning to see if he would mention the preemption of states. Well, he mentioned it with respect to the mobile bill. He didn't mention it at all with respect to his privacy framework. And it's not in the September op-ed that was published in the Hill. So for those of you that are closer to the process, give us some hope and assurance that we will see a strong preemption as part of this framework, so that we avoid a patchwork that would really render the benefits of this bill.
Does anyone want to comment on preemption in the panel?
I'll just say, I mean, from a political standpoint, it's very unlikely you're going to see a bill that does not have some kind of preemption in it. You know, will it be strong enough to satisfy NetChoice and others? I think that's an open question. We have to see the actual language. I mean, but from CDT's perspective, for us to be supportive of preemption, which we think it would be a good idea, it has to be a strong enough bill to do that as well. You can't simply have something saying you have to require notices on the web, and therefore, and then we're going to preempt all private state privacy laws, which some have suggested in the past, right? Which is so there is preemption has to come at the end of, is this a bill that actually sets good standards or not? Not at the beginning.
Today,
so
is it strong enough
Well, again, I mean, as I pointed out, even just on this opt-in, opt-out question, we don't know until you see the actual language. So it's hard to know in that space. We'd like to see other fair information practices added, like access, which is one thing that I threw out there. I think the question of who does the enforcement, especially if you do have preemption, is there a private right of action in there that even, I mean, we would like to see one that's capped the way that the TCPA is, so that you have, so you can't get outrageous class action suits in this space, but individuals can take action if you're going to have preemption. If you're going to have strong preemption in there, that's something that's important to us. So, you know, those types of things, as we start to see a bill rolled out, those are the things we're going to be looking for to determine how strongly we support the preemption in the bill and how that works.
Yeah, Chuck. I would just add the practical observation from the company perspective. People are building platforms. They take a year or two to roll out. Software has lead times. The issue with preemption is that you're usually trying to build for one market and potentially even for multinational markets, a single platform to make it the best it can be. And so I think it really is a critical issue to understand whether there has to be, you know, sort of state of main, you know, variation of your interface for your basic product. So it is a sort of business certainty. It's an issue of the highest importance for companies to know and to bring stuff to market
and to essentially to develop the economic model to go around it, that that there is some certainty that whatever interface that they provide for the consumer, they're doing it once. And the back end, and the same, I think there's a similar issue, and we're certainly talking about it in the context of enhanced notice for behavioral advertising, is, you know, what is the right framework that appropriately is malleable or scalable really from the perspective of other markets that do have a different legal approach. I can't emphasize how important that is from the perspective of the people who bring you the products.
Right, and while that topic was not referenced in the article or mentioned by Mr. Boucher this morning, I mean, this process and this initiative, as Mr. Boucher did say, really has been and will be a bipartisan effort that he is working closely with Mr. Stearns, Mr. Barton, Mr. Radonovich, as well as, you know, other Democrats. Similar to the data security bill, H.R. 2221, and that bill did include a federal preemption, and I'm sure it's part of the conversations. Jules.
Thanks. And as Stephen Volcom has tweeted, it will be iPad, and it's going to be $499, $130 more for 3G. But the other thing you are talking about when I came in was access, and there's been a lot of conversation about that. Sensitive data. The MEI has some general requirements about what's sensitive and what's not in kind of a high-level way. Chairman Bounce has talked about sensitive being a category, but nobody's really yet done a very good job at, in this online behavioral context, what exactly falls into the sensitive bucket and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. Are we going to wait until there's a bill and it gets a safe harbor and then the FTC figures it out?
Well,
they said they weren't sure what the answer was, the industry should. Where do you see that going?
Well, actually, the good news is, for those of us who've been looking for guidance in the area, the next town hall from the FTC is going to be... after the town hall. We're actually going to get some meaningful feedback on this point. So I think, you know, there's no question that it's been a difficult issue. It's not something that lends itself to a simple binary analysis. And so I think what you try to do is to have a reasonable and conservative framework here that allows, sets a fairly obvious bar to certain kinds of practices, but does allow industry working with regulators and advocates to essentially figure out sort of the rest of framework. And so I think that process is ongoing.
I think, you know, businesses are definitely looking for agreement on a standard around this. But I think, and we've been working on this for a very long time, as you are well aware, we've had hours, like hundreds of hours of phone calls trying to figure out how to define sensitive categories. Is hair loss sensitive? Well, it is to some people. It might be for women, maybe not so much for men. You know, I mean, we went down the whole list and back again, and it's kind of like trying, you know, to defining what is pornography. Well, I know it when I see it, and it's going to be different for everybody. So it is, you know, everyone's attitudes about sensitivity vary a great deal, and you see this just in general online.
Sorry, Ari was sensitive about the whole pickup truck.
Well, perhaps,
I'm,
right?
I'm talking about it publicly.
You know,
I will raise this, though. There was someone in our office. We've been going through some of these access tools. And someone in our office, I will not say who, I wonder if he or she is here, was flagged by one of these smaller behavioral ad networks as a marijuana user, which happened completely not to be true at all, right?
Are you so sure?
I'm not positive, but I'm sure enough that the person probably would not be that upset about it had it not been true, right?
Well,
and showing the whole office so there clearly are some sensitive things that people are capturing today that while this process goes forward, you know, they should not be doing. I mean, and some of these are NAI members, right?
So I think it's important to come up with some standards in this area. And when we unveiled our ad interest manager, we had a lot of conversations about, you know, what kinds of categories, what sorts of categories under the health, you know, rubric, what are those that are sensitive and which aren't? And we published the list of all the categories of our standard behavioral advertising categories, and there are some health categories there. Now, today, users can turn those categories off if they qualify for them. They tend to be very high level. I think that a lot of the sensitivity goes towards granularity, and very certain classes of health right off the bat come to mind. But I think, you know, transparency is an important part of all of this. Sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? So if we can open that kimono and give people access, I think it's going to help really further this debate. And I think that's where we are right now. I would love to see some standardization around this myself.
From Verizon, actually formerly the Air Protection Officer for MCI, which I'll remember right in the day. I find this discussion about opt-in and opt-out very interesting because I remember after the Data Protection Directive was passed in Europe, there was a lot of discussion among the privacy practice as to, you know, when an opt-in is truly an opt-in. Does it qualify as an opt-in, or is it just a contract of adhesion, things like that? So I think a lot of the debate that happened post-directive in the early 2000s, I'm never a big advocate of taking things from Europe necessarily, kind of planning a fear fight. The debate we had over whether or not things are truly opt-in, how they qualify, whether or not they're opt-out, I think could lend a lot towards the discussion in the context of this bill that's coming out. My question really has to do with cross-border data flows, and I'd be interested if anybody on the panel who deals with cross-border issues, particularly within Europe, that want to direct this question specifically to Mr. Dunn, but in the context of the framework or the directive review that's ongoing right now in New York, is there any possibility of actually getting mutual recognition? I mean, coming out of the directive passing in 95, there was the hope that we would have a framework for mutual recognition of cases and controversies and judgments among the individual data protection authorities at the national level, but it never really happened. Now that the directive is being reviewed, do people think that actually the political will for creating a truly cross-border seamless flow of information where, you know, all these different cases and controversies are recognized for national
level? Shall I start on that? I think I'm not a great, rather share your reticence about adopting EU directives wholesale into your legislature. And we try always to try our best to prevent the gold plating that tends to happen within in the UK legislature. It would seem to me, just picking up on the point that Chuck was making, that there is a great advantage to probably everybody in this room to seek to have a common standard, if we can find one. Introducing a common standard into law is not possible until we have a global government, which seems to me beyond our lifetimes, thank God. So what you're asking for, I think, is likely to be impossible. But what I think you're asking for is for standards to be as close to alignment as possible, and for the different international agencies that are involved in this to be prepared to work together, and I'm quite sure that that happens. I don't know which agency within the myriad that might have some jurisdiction here would need to get engaged with European authorities, the UK authorities. There are probably people in the room who can answer that very quickly.
Actually, I was just talking about Europe specifically because there isn't mutual recognition right now among the member states.
Well, I mean, what's happened in other states, other countries, is that their countries are granted adequacy. So Israel was just granted adequacy by the EU. Canada's been granted adequacy. I think it's unlikely that we would be granted adequacy unless we had an independent privacy commission of some kind. The FTC has not been seen as that by the Europeans. So I think just as a starting point, it's hard to even have that discussion until you have something that at least appears to be an independent privacy commissioner, data protection commissioner. So that I think is a kind of the starting point. I do think that though that if you look at the policies, especially over the last three years or so, they're starting to get to be a little closer. I mean, in terms of behavioral targeting, and Jules pointed this out at something just a couple nights ago. But that you start when you look at what has been proposed on behavioral targeting in Europe, out of Germany for their their SEAL standards, which are actually granted by the government. It looks a lot like what the FTC put out for the self-regulatory standards. So I think that you're starting to see a little bit more of what the U.S. puts out, at least having some looked at by the Europeans in this space. And I do hear from data protection commissioners some acknowledgement that our enforcement is much better than in Europe too. So I think there is, and you didn't hear that 5, 6, 7 years ago, that kind of recognition from them. I don't see adequacy happening overnight without some change in our law, specific change in our law.
I just have one other practical point in terms of, as I understand it, the data protection law flows at the national level to cover the citizens, and a lot of the ambiguity, and this is not just for internet privacy issues, but for a whole host of other jurisdictional issues. A lot of the complexity we face with multinationals is that you can have U.S.-operated platforms, technologies that are used by EU users that are not even situated in market from a server perspective, and in contrast to operations and products that are actually provided in market within the direct jurisdiction. So I think part of the problem or complexity is it raises the question of the ability of the sovereign in Europe to directly regulate the activities of a U.S. What is fundamentally a U.S. entity that happens to hold itself forth.
And that's becoming even more difficult in
Yes.
Yeah. So just to add, if I may, I think the introduction of the Information Commissioner in the U.K. came in from memory as part of the Data Protection Bill, so it was very much envisaged that we'd have that kind of policeman at the time we brought in the bill.
So this has been a little bit too cordial. I know, Ari, we all like each other. So let me reframe my initial question about Mr. Boucher's proposed bill, because I asked you to comment on the bill, but I'd like to know if anyone would take the position with respect to Mr. Boucher's bill, proposed bill or otherwise, which is, oh, for the love of God, don't legislate, that things are fine, you're not going to get it right no matter what, so please don't go down that path. And I'll just allow more time for self-regulatory efforts to take hold. And I'll open that up to start with the panelists, but if anyone else wants to comment on that, it's fine.
As the person representing a company, am I supposed to take that bait? Or
I mean, I'll start it off for you in this way, which is to say, first of all, I mean, people here have been involved in government long enough to know that the first draft of a bill is not going to be perfect for anyone, right? So I think those of us who want to see a bill introduced and promote it and promote the idea of a bill coming out, you shouldn't expect, you know, massive applause of every piece of the bill from the first in the first draft.
I think there's going to be.
I mean, that's the way it works, right? But people have a trouble saying that they're going to, you know, especially companies, but others as well, have trouble saying that they're supportive of something without seeing the actual language, right? So it makes it a lot more difficult to have that discussion.
But. Right. I mean, I think Mr. Boucher is really smart about these things, and I think he'd even admit he's probably a closet tech geek himself or maybe an open tech geek on these things. But I think he embraces that. So I think if there's someone who's likely to get it right, it's probably him. But I think that the only real fear from the corporate perspective is, you know, look, if you look at the pace of innovation, you look at the pace of technology, you know, it's just concerns about when we think about even definitionally what is a first party and a third party. Well, in a web or in a web environment where you're installing applications and it's hard to keep those lines super crisp. And I think we mostly want to make sure that there are incentives to continue to innovate. We wouldn't want to see it happen that a law comes into place and everyone just kind of meets the bar and does no more. I think we'd like to continue to see companies compete on privacy. I think that's arguably what has been happening, both in terms of data retention as well as just in terms of the tools and the things we're doing to up the ante and raise the bar on transparency and choice for consumers. So I think that's something that is difficult to do, but I'm cautiously optimistic.
I would simply add that, you know, there's no question that the prospect of legislation has focused the mind of industry very intensely. But, you know, we're still at a phase where, you know, there's really an open running room in terms of creativity of what, you know, certainly from a self-regulatory perspective, what is the right thing. I think certainly the actuality of legislation will probably, you know, focus attention back into the how to fit within this framework or that framework rather than what's the best possible approach that we would just think of from a technological perspective. So there certainly the arrival of legislation will kind of, I think, move creative energies elsewhere.
Could I just add one point? Please. I'm obviously not going to oppose the motion. I think the challenge that you have is posed not by the good guys, it's posed by the bad guys. The amount of abuse of information, the amount of fraudulent activity on the net is growing exponentially. Just to give you an illustration, in the UK, the number of phishing websites attacking UK banks and financial institutions rose more than doubled in 2008. There were 44,000 such phishing websites active that year, which it was roughly double, more than double, and the amount of money taken also more than doubled too. So this is going on, and the citizen isn't going to wear it without some kind of action.
Right, but I don't think that a new law is going to. I think existing laws will certainly should be dealing with the types of fraud and abuse that are happening online. When you look at phishing and you look at deceptive sites, or you look at hacking, or those kinds of things are definitely well within the bounds of the existing legal framework for regulators like the Federal Trade Commission to come in and take appropriate action in those cases here in the United States. I think, you know, there's the legislative, I don't want to use the word threat because it's the legislative process and potentially the result of that, but there's also, you know, we're looking also at what the Federal Trade Commission is interested in regulating and whether they will have rulemaking authority in this area and the ability to regulate online privacy as an agency. I think there's lots of interest in what Chairman Leibowitz and Director Vladek are thinking about in this area as well, and I'm sure we'll explore that more tomorrow in Berkeley and in March as well.
And I just, to your point about phishing, certainly the Can Spam Act, for those companies that were chasing after spammers, there were certain remedies that were available. The reason the statute was passed, it in large part had to do with providing more specific damages penalties for enough to actually deter and actually to make sure there were sufficient criminal penalties. But in terms of deceptive acts, fraud, when it comes to the bad actor, to the edge rider, for the creative attorney, the creative prosecutor, there are always means of under the common law, which I know you appreciate in the UK. There's all, in fact, the first spam cases were brought under the 10th century old trespass to chattels doctrine. So I do want to emphasize that from a practical perspective, there's always a way to go after the edge rider if there's enough creative lawyering. So the legislative solution is an important adjunct, but a lot of it has to do with just the hard work of doing investigative work and going after the bad actor and smoking them out from. Usually, in the internet case, this is somebody who's taken affirmative steps to use the internet to disguise themselves. So that's in contrast to the reputable company that can be served, can be found, can be shamed. So I think that's just well worth keeping in mind in terms of is legislation going to be the solution to the bad actor?
Question for Mr.
Dunn.
You talked about the tick box for opt-in in Europe. We'd love to know the experience of the frequency, the quantity of people who go ahead and check that box. It's a particular concern here where we don't have a lot of that yet, either offline or online. Because if we associate opt-in with something very serious, like sensitive information, medical, financial information, personal, sexual preferences, if we associate that checkbox with something that dire, isn't there a huge risk that if we also make a checkbox for something that's just marketing related, that we end up scaring people out of it checking the box? I mean, if Yahoo wants to share Ari's pickup truck preference before you deliver third-party ads to your page, that doesn't rise to anywhere near the traumatic decision of deciding to share my medical information by checking the box.
Well, I'm not an expert user in terms of the frequency with which people have to check boxes, but in essence, it seems to be that people can take a choice between tick box for the action and tick box for the activity, which can endure. And it will obviously depend on the type of activity, the type of service that's being provided, as to whether it's appropriate to have a reminder that, by the way, you have ticked for us to continue to use your data or to provide it to third parties or not. But they are generally, I think the attitude is, If it's information which is you're going to find embarrassing if it appears in third parties' hands, then you're not going to tick the box for repetitive use. You're just going to tick it for one-off use. And that I can see that poses some commercial challenges. Yeah.
There's been a lot of research on academic research on what people actually do and in what situations they'll do it. I really don't have much concern over the fact that businesses will be able to get people to opt in situations where they are offering a fair deal for folks. But I do worry a little bit about what Ann said before about getting overly prescriptive, an overly prescriptive opt-in where you get a pop-up every time you want to do something, right? So I think there's a balancing act there, and it works the same way as an opt-out too. There's lots of ways to build opt-outs so that no one will ever find them, right? I mean, we see that all the time, right? You have an opt-out, but you can't really use it, so what good is that, right? I mean, those are the ones that we see, you know, in some ways, most going back 2 or 3 years, most frequently on the net. But, you know, now, but you we also see these, some that are right in the line of sight, and you see lots of people seem to be able to opt out. So it depends on the situation and depends, I mean, then that's what makes it harder to say opt-in is always right for this situation, opt-out's always wrong for this situation, where you end up with this discussion about sensitive information. But I do think that it is trying to get to the right balancing point of what that opt-in and what it actually looks like. A lot of that might be better pushed off to, you know, to self-regulatory bodies like Chuck, which is why this idea of a safe harbor is of interest, or to the reg writing process, so you can get into more detail. In legislation, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to get to that level of detail.
I would just simply add that an architecture like that places particular emphasis on brand trust, and so from an internet perspective, you ask the question, is this something that it certainly works for certain kinds of business models, for the long tail, for smaller, less known entities, for, you know, it's less clear that an entire, you know, that you know, even a one opt-in model works, or one opt-out model works across the kind of the diversity that you see between smaller publishers and smaller sites, that you wouldn't necessarily have a continuing relationship. For example, you might want to consume a particular microblog and read about a story and then be done. And so then what's the scenario there for serving relevant advertising as opposed to the email platform that you check every day? I think there's some real complexity around the idea that even one opt-out or opt-in is one model is going to solve any of those issues in terms of practical consumer behavior.
The Hill article distinguishes between collection and use. So the article first says that there would be an opt-out for collection of information, even by a first party, and then there's a separate section on uses, where there would be an opt-out on use and then an opt-out of transfers to third parties. So what do people think about that distinction between an opt-out for collection versus an opt-out for certain uses or transfers?
Right. I think, you know, by and large, opt-outs have been an opt-out of use of information for, in this case, you know, behavioral advertising. We at Yahoo collect information for a lot of other reasons than simply to deliver advertising. But even in the advertising context, advertisers pay by how many times their ad was delivered. So there's a certain amount of collection you need to do just to make the model work. We do think it's entirely appropriate and right that the consumer can say, don't use it for this, don't build a profile, don't use it in your advertising systems. But if we were to put an opt-out of collection on our site and we said, hey, check this box if you want to opt out of all data being collected about you by Yahoo when you're visiting Yahoo, who are the first people who would opt out? Fraudsters would be the first people who would opt out. We're using data to help prevent against fraud and security breaches on our site. Click fraud is a well-known problem, and we combat that. But there are a lot of site security issues, along with just operational reasons why collection of the data is important. One of the things we've done is to really minimize how long we keep the data in identifiable form. So for users who are concerned about, you know, the amassing of too much information that's personally identifiable, we go through and we take steps to remove IP address and to truncate or delete or obscure cookie identifiers within that 90-day window. And that's how we address the collection issue. But we just think that to opt out of all collection would actually cause some pretty significant breakage of our model and of really just how sites run.
So let me jump off of that point. So when is data really de-identifiable? When is it really anonymous, when such that the concern is alleviated?
Well, it sort of depends on what kinds of identifiers or what kinds of information you collect in the first place. So, you know, our process, we've announced our process, and other companies have different processes for how they de-identify data, and it has a lot to do with how your systems operate, what kinds of data you receive, and how you operate. So in our case, we delete the IP address for most data at 90 days, and we have other steps that we take for browser cookies. It's called secret hashing, one-way secret hashing. It's an encryption that renders that no longer the same or even mappable back to that original identifier. With Yahoo IDs that we have on users that we record, we actually apply that encryption methodology and then truncate 50% of that identifier. And then we actually go through search log files where users will sometimes go to search and they'll type in their own name or their own address. It's called vanity searches. You ever wondered where you show up in the search results? People type their names in all the time. But also, sometimes they'll type in credit card numbers and social security numbers, and people are surprised about that. But that's very often how people find that a certain government agency has published all kinds of records or a court filing includes a social security number, because someone puts it on the web and someone's able to find their own social security number in that record. So people will do that as a way to try to protect themselves. We actually go through and we remove those identifiers from our log files for search. But those are the steps that we take. Different companies do it differently, I think, and there are going to be a few different ways to skin that cat, I think. But there's an ongoing debate about anonymity and what is true anonymity and when do you get there. And I think it's there are a lot of people writing a lot of interesting papers about where that threshold is reached.
Ari, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the health space, they've done something interesting in the U.S., which is they've said, well, you know, we can figure out mathematically that you're basically saying there's never anything that's really, truly de-identified, right? I mean, it's or completely anonymous, I guess you would say, because they use the term de-identified instead. There's never something that's completely anonymous, and if you have some bit of information, it could be possibly tied to something else. And you're never, on the other hand, you're never like 100% identifying someone just because you have a name and a social security number. You don't 100% know that that's the person that you're talking about, but there's something very close to that, right? So most things fall in between. Almost everything falls in between on that spectrum. Between completely anonymous and completely identified. And at some points, you can figure out the percentage chance of being identified. So there are mathematicians that can go through this and figure it out. One thing in the medical space, though, is a lot of that has to do with aggregate data rather than data that you know is about an individual. If you know it is about an individual, it is very likely that you can will be able to identify who that person is in some way. So there is that kind of tension in this debate as opposed to the health debate. One thing that we can do here is the steps that Anne's talked about. I mean, there are things that you can go through to try and take it and de-identify and use the state of the art in the space to figure that out. It's always going to be changing, though. That's what's important. So if we're going to try and come up with some kind of rule, it's got to be something that can be looked at every once in a while. And in the health space, they did that by saying, well, you have to prove if you're going to be doing these aggregate studies and you want to make sure that you have de-identified data, you have to have a mathematician, a licensed mathematician, that can figure this out, right, and for you and prove that to beyond a shadow of a doubt. I don't think we need to go to that level here, but we need that. But that's something that can change over time is what's important. And can we get some kind of rule in place in this space that can change over time as easily as that can?
All right, and just to add, since I know you think about this too, I think retention is the sort of other buffer that goes with the anonymization. Is the length of retention can significantly reduce the risk.
So, should there be a retention provision in a bill?
Well, I mean, I wanted to get at this your first question about when you're talking about collection and use. I think one of the main points there is really that most of the focus on privacy is for secondary uses, right? Is that we're worried about the secondary uses of it, and the questions that Anne raised about fraud and security issues. You know, there's a line there. Is that really a primary use or a secondary use of the data, right? We can have that discussion about whether you need a separate exemption or not. But in general, consumer wants their information. The reason they're giving their information is for the primary use. It's the secondary uses of data to sell it to some party without them knowing, to make a profit for the company or to get some other kind of information out of it about them that consumers have more concerns about. And so the question is, how do we get at that primary?
But is that's not a collection issue. Is it so much a use or a sharing or a... So, I mean, it's...
Right. Well, but I'm saying that I think that one of the reasons, I mean, my assumption is, I didn't, you know, draft this bill, so I don't know. My assumption is one way to get at that is sort of, well, the reason that you're, what's the reason that you're collecting this? And then the opt-out can be for secondary purposes around the collection, right? And then, and I think data retention goes to that as well. Can we try and come up with rules for data retention for the primary use of the data so that we're not keeping it around forever for no purpose whatsoever? And that's really what it comes around to. That's hard to write into, again, that's hard to write into law, but that's the theory behind the issue.
On retention, our law says that the information, and I wasn't the draftsman, I don't know precisely what it says, but it's in essence that the information should be retained for as long as its purpose is necessary. So if the purpose was to purchase a product, once the product's been purchased, then it disappears. If the purpose was for... If the purpose has a limited life, a three-month life, then once the purpose is over, the data goes.
So we've just got 4 minutes left, which is great. You each get a minute to wrap up and offer your thoughts on the online privacy framework, privacy legislation, whatever last point you'd like to make. And so we'll start actually with you, okay. Mr. Dunn.
Well, I think privacy and security go hand in hand, as we were hearing in many of the sessions earlier today. I welcome the initiative by Congressman Boucher, and I think if we can help in any way in encouraging some of the best practice that we've gone through the process both of drafting the legislation and seeing it work, and if we can be helpful in that way, we'd very much welcome the opportunity to do so. So if you're going to be the draftsman, then come on over to London and we'll have a
session. I will come to London, but I won't be the draftsman. Chuck.
I was going to say, first do no harm as a motto for legislation, and then I realized that wouldn't really work in the context of a privacy bill. So, but I would simply say that, have in mind that that the privacy debate takes place within an economic framework, that we are trying to sustain a viable ecosystem in which, policy choices will affect the kind of internet experience the kinds of services have and how they will pay for them and how it will be subsidized. And it's just vital that you keep that in mind and in effect, do no harm in the sense of not doing something that derogates from the kind of growth of internet services that we've experienced in the last decade.
Yahoo's been an advertising-supported medium for as long as we've been a commercial entity, and we offer really great products and services because we show advertising to users. I get complaints from our users when they, and I know they're an advertiser, but, the dancing baby mortgage ads and all of that, it's like, okay, I've seen enough of those. Users have an expectation, I think, today that that we're going to show them things that are relevant. And if a certain percentage of the page is taken up by an ad in order to support that service that they're getting, I think consumers are expecting and almost demanding, in fact, that that be as relevant to them as the rest of the content on that page, or else we're going to drive them away. If all they're getting on websites are annoying ads, they're going to vote with their mouse, they're going to click over, and they're going to go someplace else. So for us, privacy is a key part of maintaining a trusted relationship with our users, but the reason they come to us is because they're getting the types of products and services and the experience that they want to have. And if they're not getting that, they're going to leave. So we're doing our best to try to make that whole experience relevant for consumers. And I think it's so far it's been pretty effective. And I think behavioral advertising has a long way to go yet to meet its promise. I think when we think of legislation, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of getting, actually taking benefits away from consumers that help them access a great deal of amazing products and services for free today.
There's no doubt that trying to put together a comprehensive privacy framework, right, whether it's law or it's through other kinds of policies, is going to be difficult. And there are a lot of different moving parts to this, and the changes in technology make it difficult as well. But I think that one of the key points is that if we can have reasonable discussions like this one, where we talk out some of these issues and try to come up with consensus answers over the years, that we can end up with a bill that both helps consumers and, in the long run, will help business as well and help business thrive in this space by adding more certainty adding a higher level of trust to new technologies.
Okay, well, I want to thank our panelists very much. It was a thoughtful, not heated, but thoughtful conversation. And I thought it helped move the discussion forward. So I thank you very much.